I am Rick Shear, and I am counsel for the Kinkale Ranch Metropolitan District and the individual taxpayers who brought the counterclaims in this case. It's before the court today. With me is Alan Call, the attorney that tried the case with me, and present in the courtroom are a number of directors of both districts and many of the citizens and homeowners of the Kinkale Ranch Metropolitan District. I would like to reserve about 5 minutes if I can, so I'll try and wrap up in time to do that. This case really involves many issues, many facts, some in dispute, some not in dispute. Some of the legal issues are issues of first impression. From an attorney's point of view, it makes the case very interesting. From the court's point of view, it probably makes the case a little difficult. But I think that the statutory language in question is clear enough that this court is going to be able to decide the case based on the statute and the service plan language at issue, which means for the most part, this appeal really is a question of law, involves questions of law. But the central issue.
Mr. Chairman, before you get there, let me start with an issue they may not want to start with. And,
sure.
And I think it's a fact issue in terms of knowledge, knew or should have known, and the statute of limitations. What do you do with the trial court's finding of fact that it was understood, certainly by the district and by the individual taxpayers in the late 1990s, that Plains was not going to issue any more debt? And therefore, the facilities could not have been built. They would have knew or should have known by the late or mid to late 1990s that no more debt would be issued and therefore no facilities would be built.
Well, I didn't want to get to that issue now because obviously that's not our strength, but there's an inferential leap that the trial court made. Just because the district is not going to issue debt does not mean it's repudiating the duty to build the recreational facilities. It has many other sources of revenue, even today. And in fact, the evidence at trial was it was financially feasible, practicable today to build it based on the assessed value that there is today without even increasing the taxes. And they're not limited by Tabor. The evidence at trial showed they were not limited by Tabor. They can do this with a current mill levy. There was no repudiation during any of those discussions of the duty to build the rec facilities. For the trial court to make that inferential leap was just wrong. And if you look at Exhibit 137, which is a discussion outline, I've got the wrong one. It's 100. A discussion outline, you threw me off of my organization here. Just a moment, and I'll get the, here it is, Exhibit 137. The court errs in two places related to what happened at those meetings that took place. First of all, those meetings were a discussion to consolidate Plains and Kinkale Ranch Metropolitan District. They weren't a discussion of all kinds of things, including consolidation, as counsel for Plains would have you believe. That's just not the case. All of this was in the context of consolidation of the districts. And first, the court made a mistake as to her conclusion that the golf course was built on the very spot that the soccer fields and the ball fields were going to be built, because that's not what was discussed. In this document on page 8, number 1999, it says it would be built in the general area of where the golf course was. It could be beside it. It could be next to it. It could be 300 yards away in the general area.
On the debt issue, yeah. you agree that's a finding of fact. You accept the finding that they knew no more debt was going to be issued, but you say that the factual inference from that finding is not supported? That
yes.
No debt, ergo, no
yes.
building.
Yes, because at this time, if you read that entire document, you'll see that what they're saying is, what mill levy will be required for the cost of building rec facilities? This is in the context of consolidation. And what it says is zero. And why? It says because they're going to have the commercial tax base. That's two questions down. And if you look at the third question down, it says we can build these additional rec facilities because we're going to have a sufficient increase in the tax base from the developed commercial area. That's Plains. Developed commercial area if we consolidate. That's what this is all about. To take that one sentence out of context really is a clear error on the part of the court. She took the whole document out of context, and there was no testimony to the contrary.
And you've got your argument as a matter of law and revival statute. So anyway, go back into where you wanted to be.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to take you down a different path slightly. Pardon me, Mr. Shearer. But I have an amended counterclaim that was filed August 4th of 2004. Is that the one that you went to trial on?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
All right. And I don't see anything in that August 4th counterclaim that makes a specific claim under Section 321207. Is that correct?
There's no citation to that statute. The case was tried from the beginning to the end on that statute, though. It was cited throughout the pleadings.
I'm very unclear about whether it was tried as a breach of contract case or as an enforcement case under the statute.
We sought injunctive relief, which is exactly the kind of relief that statute grants, specifically, expressly states that's the kind of relief. But we did not cite the statute, Your Honor.
Well, then I'm concerned about why there are no findings of fact with respect to what's required under Section 3A, which is whether this was a material departure from the service plan and whether it conformed so far as practical to the approved service plan. There are no findings of fact on that, so it leads me to believe that it was tried as a breach of contract claim instead.
Your Honor, in the record, in the trial briefs, in the proposed findings of fact, conclusions of law, that section, that statute is expressly discussed. The fact that the court did not address it in findings of fact, conclusions of law and order is, I believe, a result of the courts having decided the case on the threshold issue that service plans are not generally, across the board, are not enforceable because they're only guidelines. And I believe that's a clear error on the part of the court. And I think that's why she didn't reach that issue, because she says right in her findings, anything else I didn't rule on is because I didn't find it to be material. And that's her statement. And so there are several things that she didn't rule on that we think are very important in this case. For example, she made no ruling on latches. And that issue was briefed extensively, argued extensively, and one of the claims was for promissory estoppel. There are just gaps in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. And Your Honor, I submit that is a gap that I cannot account for, but the fact she didn't make a finding on that issue doesn't mean that the case wasn't tried on that basis.
Let me follow up Judge Terry's question. If we examine the trial briefs and the oral arguments, will we find a specific articulation that your clients were entitled to an injunction under the material departure provision of the statute?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May I go forward?
Sure.
The other thing I've mentioned in response to Judge Connolly's question just before we leave it is, a few years after that meeting that you're referring to, that one of the directors of Plains, Dennis Carruth, took two directors of Ken Carroll around in his car and showed them alternative locations for those ball fields when it was realized that the golf course would actually be built on the site. And so even Plains didn't think that particular meeting, those consolidation discussions, meant they weren't supposed to do what they were going to do.
At that meeting, was the discussion that if we consolidate, we'll be able to build it? Plains wasn't going to go it alone and build it at that meeting? Or was that the whole context, was a consolidation of district meeting?
That would be correct. Because that was the concept, is that's where the commercial tax base would come from to build additional recreational facilities.
And that consolidation never happened. Obviously, you went to war instead of merging.
Well, I don't know if they went to war. For a long time, they coexisted with even the same manager, Mr. Peake. They just didn't ever come to terms on this particular issue. And throughout, this gets to the rest of the statute of limitations issue, on the issue of practicability. Throughout the 90s, the 80s, late 80s, 90s, Into the late 90s and early 2000s, they started developing this area. There was a development slowdown, which is what the service plan says could postpone, not eliminate, but postpone building these recreational facilities. There wasn't even a claim that could be enforced until then. And the evidence at trial in the form of the testimony of both Mr. Peek, the manager for Plains, Mr. Wines, who had managed Plains before that as a co-manager for Ken Carroll and Plains, Dennis Carruth, and the documentary evidence, the exhibits showed from their budgets that there was money to build this because all of this property was coming on the tax rolls with a two-year lag. And that by 2009, 2010, where we are now, there would be a lot of money, but as of 2004, there was enough to pay for all of this, and it was could be paid for using the same level of taxation. Granted, it wouldn't be for a bond, it would be a general mill levy, as what was levied for the bonds to retire their for their infrastructure, you know, because that was done.
If we get to practicability, though, it seems to me that we need a finding of the trial court on that at the very least. I mean, if you get through all the hoops you have to get to and you get to that final statutory hoop of practicability, I quite frankly don't see how we could make that finding in the first instance.
Well, I saw counsel's argument for remand, and as much as I would prefer to have it decided here on the record, I think there's more than adequate evidence on the record. It may be more appropriate for remand for that fact finding, and we would go for that if that's what you think we have to do. I'd really rather you end it here. We've had this case a long time.
if we went the remand route, do you see any reason why either side should have an opportunity to present additional evidence, or should the remand be just for findings based on the existing record?
Yes, I like the latter, only for findings based on the existing record. We addressed this issue. We put in mountains of evidence on this issue, the financial feasibility. Also, they tried to graft, the Plains tried to graft a need argument on top of practicability, the statutory word. And, you know, the need argument, first of all, you have to understand there's no evidence in the record that their board ever decided they weren't going to build these because there wasn't a need. Their board never took any action like that. No notice meeting, no meeting, no resolution, no finding that wasn't any need. That came grafted into this case after the lawsuit was filed.
Just follow up quickly on anyone rebuttal on Judge Webb's question. This was tried in 08. Right. If we remanded, wouldn't practicability be an 010 issue? Wouldn't there have to be some consideration of what's practicable in 010, practicable in 010 as opposed to 08?
Well, it works to our advantage. There's been a ton. The evidence at trial was that there were lots and lots of buildings under construction, and they'd be coming on the tax rolls in 2 years.
Maybe more new evidence then.
If we want to go and reopen the evidence, we can, and I'm not going to object on that grounds because I think it'll help us. It's just building out. And the needs are increasing all the time. They don't have soccer fields. They don't have ball fields. The evidence at trial was there's an increased need for tennis courts, and the pools are aging, and they need the new pool. The three things that are specifically described with a specific budget, and that's what's so different about this service plan. And whether it's unique or not unique really isn't the issue. The issue is whether there's a significant enough departure that Ken Carroll Ranch Metropolitan District and the taxpayers, who are all interested parties, can ask the court to enforce it. That's the issue, not whether it's unique or not unique. I mean, I'm guilty. I'm the one that raised the unique issue. But there was no evidence at the trial that it was unique or not unique. It's very detailed, very specific, and it's not being followed because Plains has said one thing, not that it's not needed.
You're running out of rebuttal time.
I can see that. But rather, they're saying that the reason that it shouldn't be built is because they don't have to. That's their argument. They just don't have to. So I'll save the last half minute. Thank you.
Your Honor, if it pleases the court, my name is John Watson. I represent the Plains Metropolitan District. My registration is 7322. Service plans are not enforceable contracts. The statute says so. The Plains Service Plan says so.
What does the statute say? I don't think the statute says anything about contract enforceable or not, does it? Or I might be missing.
It doesn't specifically talk about contract, Your Honor, but Section 207 says, the facilities, services, and financial arrangements of the special district shall conform so far as practicable to the approved service plan. The statute itself, Your Honor, overcomes any contract claim, any equitable claim because of that.
Let me follow up right there. It uses the word shall. Your service plan throughout in terms of facilities said will, typically mandatory terms. Agree?
Only agree to the extent that it must be qualified by the other terms of the plan itself, Your Honor. The plan itself in its introduction states specifically, this is a general plan for the future direction of the district. In the financing section, it gives complete discretion in the plan, in the charter, to the board of directors to proceed and postpone any improvements based on developmental delay, economic, or other factors. So to the extent that it is qualified with those other terms in the statute itself and the plan, says we are planning to build these things. Yes, it was prairie dog territory when they started in 1985. There was nothing there. That's the point.
And the flexibility provision you cite says postpone, which is seems to be, it's a matter of when, not if. But in any event, on the shell as far as practicable, is it your position that a service plan that uses mandatory language, if we found this one mandatory, is unenforceable in its entirety, or that there's a practicability component to enforceability?
There's a practicability component, and there's a discretion component directly attributable to the charter from the language of the plan. The board of directors serve at the will of the electors and the taxpayers. They have to act responsibly, and the Plains Board did act responsibly in this case in regard to the taxpayers themselves.
Let me follow up Judge Connolly's question, because I didn't get a sense of an answer. If the court were to have made findings that building these facilities was practicable, then why aren't the plaintiffs entitled to a mandatory injunction under Section 3A?
Because there is no material departure from the plan. Neither this court, nor the trial court, nor the Ken Carroll district gets to be the sixth man on the basketball field or the 13th man on the football field. Well, that team, the board of directors, must make that decision in best interest of the taxpayer.
Okay, so you're saying that they have absolute discretion?
They have absolute discretion to proceed in the best interest of the taxpayers, yes. No matter how the plan is written, because, Your Honor, it's a plan. It's not a contract. Indeed, in the Durnford case, the third leg of the table of why this is service plans are not contracts is the Durnford case. This court in 1971 ruled that a fire district was not required to build fire hydrants or a water supply system. Your Honors, there isn't a trap. The very reason for existence of a fire district is to fight fires. And if this court says that a fire district doesn't have to build fire hydrants or a water supply system, how can you say that a plan made by a district to build in prairie dog territory, if it's needed, swimming pools, tennis courts, and ball fields, is required? That's exactly why the statute says conform so far as practical. I apologize, Your Honor.
Mr. Watson, the statute would seem to disagree with your concept of absolute discretion, because it gives the court the power to enjoin a material departure from the service plan. So how can that be absolute discretion?
Your Honor, I turn back to your question about the initial claim. There is nothing in the claim that recites that this was a material departure from implementation of the plan. It was a contract claim and an equitable claim.
Well, it doesn't actually mention contract either. What it says is it's framed as a 106A2 claim, oddly, but your opposing counsel seems to indicate that his side specifically briefed and argued and presented proposed findings and conclusions of law that would have invoked this injunctive relief under 2073A. Is that correct or not?
That I don't know specifically as to the reference to that statute. I know that the claims that were addressed in the counterclaims and the amended counterclaims were contract and equity. And I'm suggesting to you that if service plans are determined to be contracts in this state, you're turning 40 years of special district jurisprudence on its head.
Well, even assuming that that's true, did they make a claim, a cognizable claim, under the statute for injunctive relief, regardless of the contract issue?
I do not believe so, Your Honor, because there was no material departure. And indeed, the judge addressed that when she said when we amended the plan in 2005, nothing changed material in the plan.
Actually, you're jumping ahead of my question, because you're getting into what proof there was or was not as to whether it was a material departure. What I'm trying to find out was this tried as a statutory injunction case under the statute?
Your
as
Honor.
As opposed to a breach of contract.
The focus at trial was the appellant's argument, Ken Carroll's argument, that this was a contract enforceable under the law. That was the trial issue. We responded with no, but even if it is a contract, statute of limitations has long since passed.
And on the first point, though, and staying there, you responded that a service plan is never enforceable. And that's where I'm stuck on the statutory language, that you shall comply, admittedly, if practicable. But your position is, or shall conform, your position is may conform if you think it's in the best interest of the district.
If it's in the best interest of the district, given the plan and the purpose of your plan, if you're a fire district and you're trying to build recreation facilities, yes, that's a material departure. If it's the reverse, if we were a recreation district and we wanted to do things that were a water district's purposes or a fire district's purposes, that's a material departure. And we could not do that. Of course, we couldn't do that. So within the confines of the purpose of our plan, yes, it's enforceable. Within the confines of the plan, what we are planning to do, we as a board of directors must make that decision based on the best interest of the taxpayers. We're not going to go build swimming pools, tennis courts, and ball fields if they're not needed. We're not going to spend tax money or bond money to do that.
But if the plan says they are needed and you shall build them, and take aside the flexibility provision, if you're saying they shall be built no later than January 1, 2000, your position would still be you don't have to conform with that if you decide change circumstances.
If there's a change in circumstances, yes. So far as practicable. If you can't afford it, if you can't get the bonding, Your Honor, yes. That board would have to sit down and say, listen, we're going to go bankrupt. And indeed, this Plains District almost did.
But we never got to that issue. The trial court never got to practicability. And your position is the trial court didn't have to get there.
Didn't need to get there.
And that's where I'm struggling with. I don't know what shall conform means if it doesn't mean shall conform.
Shall conform as so far as practicable. It doesn't say the appellants recited the Muckrow case for the concept that as soon as practicable means at the earliest feasible opportunity. Well, that case doesn't fit at all because it's not in the context of the special district case, and the language is different. It's not as soon as practicable. The statute says so far as practicable. The concept of practicable by its very nature, Your Honor, embraces discretion.
And you may be right, but we never got there. Your position is doesn't mean shall conform.
No, Your Honor, that's not my position. My position is she didn't have to get to that point because she properly ruled that it's not a contract, an enforceable contract. And any claims, if it were a contract, were barred by the statute of limitations. They sat on their hands for too long. She didn't have to get to the practicability and the need. We think there was lots of evidence as to that. Indeed, counsel who stood before you just now said the issue is need in the trial. The issue is need. It was a headline in our proposed findings and conclusions because that was an admission he made from the trial court level. But she didn't need to get there.
Let me ask you a question, and following up on what Judge Webb asked your counterpart, if we decided that a finding of practicability was required, is it your position that finding should be made on the existing record? You asked for a remand in the alternative, understanding of the fallback, or that you should have a chance, both sides should have a chance to introduce evidence of practicability as of the date that the trial court's actually going to have to make that finding?
It would make no difference to us, Your Honor. Either way, they're going to come out the same way.
So you would not be asking to introduce any evidence. You'd be happy with the 08 record.
Yes, Your Honor.
And Mr. Watson, the statute of limitations defense that you asserted was only under the contract statute of limitation? Is that correct?
Whatever the arguments we made were, Your Honor, any applicable statute of limitations of any kind is going to bar these claims. She ruled that the contract statute of limitations was the applicable one, and yes, that's the one.
So did you assert more than one? Because you were required to put it specifically in your answer or your reply to the
question. Yes, we did. In our affirmative defenses, and indeed throughout, we said whatever applicable statute of limitations there is, whatever limitations period, whether you determine, you know, they sat on their hands and latches applies.
You realize that's not sufficient. You have to state which statute you're citing.
And we did, Your Honor.
All right. I'll take a look at it. Thank you.
And how do you, on the statute of limitations issue, how do you respond? I think I understand their golf course argument, but how do you respond to the issue of knew there was going to be no more debt? That's a factual finding, but then the further inference that therefore no debt, no building of the facility. Where is the support for that further inference in the record?
Beyond what you've already focused on, Your Honor, it was the task force. We argued several triggers for the statute of limitations. We went all the way back, Your Honor, to 1988. And that's one critical point that the appellants ignore that is critical for you to focus on. Plains was established in 1985. They operated for 3 years before the Ken Carroll District ever came into existence. In 1988, 3 years later, the Ken Carroll service plan then said, we've got a large community to deal with. We've got a Plains District. We're setting up a new Ken Carroll District. We've got recreational facilities for the incoming people. Again, we're talking prairie dog territory. So let's work together.
The trial court found that, as I understand, the trial court found two triggers. One, that when the golf course was built in a location that the recreation couldn't be built there. I'd rather, you can focus on it if you want, but the question I had was on the second finding that they knew or should have known by the mid to late 90s that no more debt was going to be issued, and therefore without debt, the facilities could not have been built. I'd like to focus on the second prong of that finding.
I'm very comfortable with that, Your Honor, but we need to go back into history to 1988. When Ken Carroll did their service plan, they said, on these recreational facilities, their plan specifically said, we're going to deal with that in a separate agreement, in an intergovernmental agreement. There shall be an intergovernmental agreement. We drafted one. We fought over it. We never came to an agreement. As the judge found, there was no meeting of the minds. In other words, here's the charter, the Plains plan and charter, the Ken Carroll plan and charter, and we need a separate contract to deal with the details of these facilities, design, finance, build, construct, operate, and maintain. We needed, and we're going to do that. So we fought about it for a long time, never came to a deal. Subsequent to that deal falling through, and we didn't have that separate enforceable contract, there were these task force meetings focused on, as you suggested, the consolidation of these two districts. Couldn't cut a deal there either. And it was in the context of those that Plains said, listen, we did development bonds. We're going to pay them off in 2003, 2004, some time frame. But we're not going to issue any more debt for anything else. We've built the trails that we're going to build. We built the highways and the signals or the roads that we're going to build. We're not going to do anything else. That trigger was at a minimum. We suggest, Your Honor, though, that the set, and we argued, statute of limitations went back further, went all the way to 1988. You knew in 1988 we didn't have a meeting of the minds on any of this recreational stuff. You should have sued us then. Statute of limitations under contract expired in 1991. There was another trigger when the task forces fell apart and said, we're not going to consolidate either. We want to set up a separate deal for all these recreations. We couldn't do it then. So you couldn't do it in 88, couldn't do it in the mid-90s. And then the golf course came in. And if you want this to be an enforceable contract term, they want to have their cake and eat it too. It's a contract, but don't enforce that provision that says that the ball fields are going to go here. The plan specifically in its map identifies the location for those ball fields. Specific. Look at the testimony of Dennis Carruth. Dennis Carruth identified the very spots which are circled on the Plains map in the plan for where those ball fields are going to go. Change in circumstances. Couldn't cut a deal in 88. Task force for consolidation doesn't go forward. And boom, the golf course comes in. Well, we want you to build the swimming pool, ball fields, and tennis courts. but we don't want you to enforce that provision of the contract. We want you to put it someplace else.
That provision didn't say will be built in a location. At least, was there any language that said will?
I can identify, Your Honor, the spot on the map in the plan, Exhibit 1, that says the ball field shall go there.
It said shall?
Well, it doesn't say shall.
It didn't say shall or will, did it?
Well, it doesn't say shall or will. It says, as identified on the map. And in the map, you see a little circle, and that's where the ball fields are to go. And Dennis Kruth's testimony specified that. So that if this is other than a charter, other than a plan, if this is a contract, that's a contract term that should be enforced. They don't want to do that. They don't want to tear up the golf course. That's crazy, and I agree. That's crazy. But that's just another manifestation of the generality of what this charter, this plan is. As Mr. Light says in his Colorado Lawyer article in 2004, these are charters. These aren't contracts enforceable on the ground. If indeed Ken Carroll wanted to do it, they said, we shall do it by a separate intergovernmental agreement. And that happens all the time. An enforceable intergovernmental agreement. We couldn't come to terms.
I think your time is exhausted.
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
I'm dragging all of these up here because I allowed myself to be misled by the court. Not only did we plead that we wanted an injunction in our second amended counterclaims, we actually cited the statute. I can give the court the page number, not because I'm so good at finding things, but because my partner over here, Mr. Call, is really good at finding them, and I forgot. If I could direct the court, page 9 of the amended counterclaims, second supplemental counterclaim for relief, injunctive relief, paragraph number 44. Then if you go
to... What's the date of that pleading, please?
Pardon?
What's the date of that pleading?
I don't know.
What I'm looking at doesn't have that many
paragraphs. Oh, it's the second supplemental. So I'll find a date for you, Your Honor. It is June 22nd, 2007. And then in our findings of fact and conclusions of law, we expressly address the enforcement of the service plan. And that would be on page 19. And we went through the same discussion that we did in our appellate briefs. And then the court actually addressed it specifically, and I didn't realize that when I was addressing the court earlier. And in the court's findings and conclusions, and I am sorry, they're not numbered. But it looks like it's about page 15 or so. Well, it's actually, I can tell you, it's 3 pages from the back. About halfway down, there's a discussion by the court that goes on for about 3 paragraphs of 32.1, 207.3a, and it's in the arguments that we made in the trial court on that issue. So I think we covered the base on that one. A couple other things I'd like to address is the language of the plan is very clear as to what shall and will be done. To say that...
Counsel, I think your time is exhausted as well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course, and on that basis, counsel are excused, and when the tables are cleared and any of our spectators wish to leave, we'll take up argument in our third case.